conversation with queer identified writers about their works and lives.
Welcome to Queer Words. This is Wayne Goodman, and on this episode, I have the delightful pleasure of conversing with Trent Clifford. Hey, Trent.
Hey, Wayne. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Could we start by having you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
I am a newly published author, and primarily outside of that realm, a theater maker. As a professional writer, I got into this through playwriting. I was a director and then a playwright, and most recently, an author. A while back, I got my Master's of Divinity from a seminary here in Texas. This book is me marrying a lot of these professional endeavors I've taken over the past bunch of years and putting them into a book. It takes my academic achievements in seminary and marries them with my love of writing that I found through theater.
This is Queer Words, and I do ask my guests, what qualifies you as queer?
I am a married gay man in the South. My husband and I will be celebrating our one-year anniversary at the end of July.
When did you first accept being queer?
I grew up in a pretty conservative household environment, very conservative Christian. For me, being queer was not really an option growing up. The messaging was that this was a choice that people made. I quote unquote chose not to be. All through my adolescence, I didn't struggle with my queer identity. I had boxed it so deeply inside of me that it was pretty much non-existent, at least to my consciousness, right? It wasn't until I was 22 that I came to grips with it. And it came about in a cataclysmic way because I had been dating a woman for many years. In Southern Christian culture, when you've been dating someone for long enough, the questions start rolling in. When are y'all going to get married? When are you taking the next step? I did what I thought I was supposed to do. I proposed to this woman who was, in hindsight, a very dear friend. We were so compatible and we got along so well. And I thought that's what love was. But I proposed to her and she's overjoyed. I immediately knew I had made a terrible mistake. I didn't even know why. At the time, I just knew that this is not how you're supposed to feel when you propose to someone. Over the next couple of months, I figured out what those feelings were. I told her, we broke things off. I spent the next year figuring out what this meant for my life. I was already in seminary when I came out. I had all these questions as a person of faith. Can I be a person of faith at all and be queer, let alone can I be a person of faith ordained to ministry and be queer? I spent the next year sorting through these questions for myself and figuring out how my identity could or couldn't coalesce with these things that had been so important to me for my whole life. I don't know that I struggled with whether I was queer. I accepted my queerness pretty quickly when I realized what was going on. The journey was, how much of this faith can I bring with me now that I'm accepting my queerness? And the full acceptance of bringing those identities together would have come sometime during my 23rd year of life. During that next year, I figured out that these things were comparable, that they were beautiful together, that they didn't stand in opposition, but that I could be a man who deeply valued my faith, also a man who loved other men, and that both of those things were beautiful and okay.
Would you have some queer hero figures?
That is really difficult. And I've been asked this question before because I didn't grow up with that being an option. I didn't grow up being allowed to value those people in society. When I think about queer hero figures now, I don't know that it's so much people anyone would recognize. It's the queer people in my own life who helped to show me that this is possible. There's a queer woman in my life who started a preaching conference specifically for women and for queer voices. She would be one of my queer hero figures, right? There are people in my life who have pointed me in this direction and said, this is for you. Your voice matters at this intersection of faith and sexuality. I have dear friends that I might consider hero figures, but because I didn't allow myself to take part in queer culture until the last 6 years of my life, I don't know that I have as many people that folks would recognize to name here.
What about literary influences?
My book is in part memoir. There's more to it than simply my story, but my book has a lot of my story inside of it. It's not just a theological book. It's a book that parallels my story. One of the things about me that is important is that I'm a survivor of domestic violence. I was married once before my current lovely marriage. Reclaiming my life post-divorce, I realized paralleled in a lot of ways what it looked like to reclaim my faith after this forced separation between the church and myself. My book is a lot of my story. My primary literary influences are memoirists. People talk about Glennon Doyle a lot, and I know that it's maybe overused, but I think she's a really beautiful example of telling stories in a nonlinear way, that it doesn't have to be first this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. She has captured the fact that life is not linear in that way a lot of the time. We may age linearly, but also we don't. This story from 3 years ago circles back to the present and informs the way that we make our next choice. That leads us on this merry road down towards something else. Reading her book, Untamed, opened my eyes to what memoir can be, and that it doesn't have to be biographical, but that it can be emotions and vignettes and the ways in which our life story influences the choices that we make and the things that we learn.
What inspired you to begin writing?
I came to this realization that reclaiming my life post-divorce after an abusive relationship and reclaiming my faith after this abusive relationship with the church were more similar than I might have at first realized they were. I reached a point in my life where I felt like I had done all the things I needed to do to reclaim my life post-divorce.
Catharsis through writing?
Absolutely. Writing is a beautiful way to process, and I have long loved writing. I have been a poet and a playwright, and there's poetry suffused throughout the book as well. There are a couple of excerpts plucked from my journal and plopped into the book.
Any epiphanies?
Plenty. That's why I am hopeful that the book is powerful, because I was blessed with a lot of epiphanies along the way, and I was shocked at how many lessons carried over from one journey to another. Some of the epiphanies are minute, and yet at the time, they were so important.
How does queerness impact your writing?
My identity as a queer man suffuses all of it, particularly as a queer man of faith. I have to use my imagination in ways that other people aren't forced to. That's a gift, to be clear. Figuring out what faith still has for me required me to think outside of the box that had been given to me, because I didn't fit there. I tried to fit there for many years and it didn't work. I still found my way out of it. Then I had to figure out what this meant for me. It's funny because my parents still struggle with the word queer, because in their generation, it was more of an insult, right? If you go back far enough, queer really meant strange, which is why at one point it was an insult. But the queer community has done such a beautiful job of reclaiming this word. I don't know that strange is necessarily the insult that people intended it to be. It's lovely to be a little bit strange. In some ways, a synonym for strange could be unique. I have a very unique point of view as a writer. I have been forced to imagine what life as a queer man of faith could be because I didn't have examples growing up of what this could look like. I've had to imagine, what does this look like for me? What do I want my path to be? What do I want my life to look like? Because I've had to use my imagination to sort some of those things out, it makes me a better interpreter of scripture. It makes me a better arbiter of theology. As a queer person, I have a lens that is important, not just for queer folks, but for anyone. That's the beauty of queer writers in general. we have something to offer. It's a point of view that other people simply won't have because they don't have the same lived experience. They haven't had to imagine a life for themselves that other people weren't already living.
When it comes to your writing process, do you like to start with an outline and work from that structure, or do you sit down and start typing away? And how does that differ when you're working on a book from when you're working on a script?
This is a great question, and I am a terrible person to ask because I don't do any of the things you're supposed to do as a writer. Even when I teach writing, I teach people what they're supposed to do, not what I do. In the book, it illustrates this alongside my writing is I figured this out as I went. I started with an introduction, but at the time I didn't know it was an introduction. I was just writing. From there, it flowed into chapter one. I started laying groundwork for what this journey would be and figuring out, okay, what is my next step? What do I do now? Then I found myself writing a chapter about baby steps, how you don't have to take big steps. You can take little steps. And sometimes those little steps don't feel like they're anything important, but later you'll realize they are. It just evolved. And so I didn't have a structure. It was truly me journeying and documenting that journey. I would send what are now chapters to a friend to read as I went so that I had a little bit of accountability because I knew that it was something I wanted to document. From the beginning, I knew that there was something here that I would want to share. As I finished the journey, I finished the book. The two coincided. That's how this book came to be, was me documenting my own steps as I figured out how to re-enter the realm of organized faith. With plays, it is a little different. I probably don't do what you're supposed to do when you write plays, but usually there's a spark. There's a story inside of me that wants to be told. I figure out who the characters are. That's always where I start, especially with a play. Characters have to have a unique voice. You need to be able to close your eyes and know which character is which. I figure out who the characters in the story are, flesh them out. Then I pop them into a room, so to speak, and let them have at it. I describe my playwriting process as me sitting, eavesdropping, and watching things unfold and documenting it. That's a beautiful example of letting imagination run wild and taking note is what happens when I write a play. Afterwards, I'll go back and smooth things out and massage this or rearrange this because in terms of dramatic sequence, this will make more sense. But especially that first draft, I just plop characters into a storyline and let them run wild. That's what works for me. And it's probably the least organized way that anyone can possibly write. I often complain to my husband about not having an outline. And he's always like, you could just make an outline. Then I give him a look that's like, you know that I can't do that. Stop saying crazy shit. Then we move on because we both know I'm not going to. Every writer has their own weird little process that works for them. I'd let things unfold and then I make sense of it afterward.
If people are interested in reading your book, where can they find it?
They can go to my website, reclaimingfaith.org, and find out more about me and get the link for the book there. They can also type in Reclaiming Faith by Trent Clifford, and it'll pop up on Amazon and they can get it there.
I'm hoping you can share some of your writing with us.
I would love to. I am going to read an excerpt of Reclaiming Faith, Learning to Reimagine Church, God, and Ourselves. I'm going to read just the first part of the first chapter, and I think the only thing that you need to know is that I am a survivor of domestic violence, so it references an abusive ex, and if you don't know that that's what I'm referencing, it might not make sense, so I want to say that up front. It opens with a poem and then goes into the chapter. I've always been a lover of words, a logophile, if you will. Yet for someone who cherishes a clever turn of phrase, it is remarkable how often I am left phraseless, unable to articulate the goings-on inside my heart and mind, but sometimes a simple phrase can be replaced by a book. I'm a bibliophile first, it seems. Chapter 1. A word nerd always defines their terms. I guess it's unsurprising, given that I'm a writer, that I love words. I love the way that finding the right word feels when you know it really provides the full picture of a thing. I love the way that words can be strung together to make people feel something they weren't expecting those words to make them feel. I love the way words feel in your mouth when you speak them aloud for the first time, uttering something so perfectly true. Words have meaning and they have definition. Sometimes those are the same thing, and sometimes they're not. In the case of reclamation, I knew what meaning the word held for me. It meant seizing back as my own those things which had been taken from me. It meant stepping back into the fullest version of myself that I had allowed to slip away. But I wasn't sure if that was the definition. I had to look that part up. And there's your proof, in case you weren't yet sure, that I am indeed a nerd. So here is reclamation defined. 1, the process of claiming something back or of reasserting a right. 2, the cultivation of wasteland or land formerly underwater. Now, the first definition is pretty close to the meaning I had ascribed to it. The second definition is an agricultural term and therefore seems unrelated to our discussion, but metaphorically speaking, I almost like it better than the first. When we're reclaiming something, we are recognizing that there are parts of ourselves that were formerly underwater, drowned by societal expectation, prejudice, patriarchy, a particularly painful interaction, or any number of things. When we look at those drowned parts of who we are, they seem to be a wasteland, but if we till that ground, it is still fertile, waiting for the opportunity to regrow something beautiful. So when I talk about what it means to reclaim something, you can pick which definition you want to be your own. It can mean reasserting a right that you've allowed yourself to lose. It can mean claiming something back that was stolen from you. It can mean cultivating a part of yourself that has lain dormant for too long. Or it can mean all of those things at once. However you define it for yourself, though, the process of reclaiming starts here. Taking an honest look at yourself and determining what it is that needs to be reclaimed. If we aren't willing to look inward, taking an authentic inventory of our inner landscape and admit which parts of it have become wasteland, then we will never be able to enter into reclamation with a clear way forward. It is essential that we survey ourselves fully, name those parts that have been drowned without blaming ourselves for the devastation that was wrought there, and acknowledge that it is time to cultivate new life. Often living in these wastelands are shadows of what once were that haunt us. In the case of my ex-husband, his fingerprints were everywhere. Everywhere I looked, he was in the shadows. As I reclaimed every inch of myself that he had drowned with himself, I had to drive him out in order to make room for me. I had been forced to make myself smaller than I actually was, and as I stretched some of my me muscles that I hadn't used in so long, it was scary. It was painful. But the more light I shed on those lands that had been in the dark, the fewer shadows there were for him to hide in.
What's your involvement in the queer communities?
My primary involvement in the queer community is through theater. I live in a growing but still relatively small city. The theater company that I started almost 4 years ago now is truly one of the bastions of queer life in this city. Over 50% of the actors and creatives that work with me are queer. We've carved out this piece of culture that is ours. We get to tell queer stories on stage. We get to tell stories on stage, but with queer bodies, right? And those are not necessarily the same thing, but both are really important. We get to show who we are through what we have decided is important as a theater company. It's really a gift. It can be hard sometimes because I'm one of the few public-facing queer people here. I'm one of the only out and proud gay directors around, the only one that will produce the kind of work that we produce on stage. But it is exciting at the same time to be able to create community with people that you care about, with people that you know may not find that same community elsewhere if this space wasn't created. That's my involvement with the queer community, is wanting to make space for us and create visibility for us in the place where we live.
How do you use social media to promote your work?
I am online on reclaimingfaith.org, and then on Instagram, I am at Reclaiming Your Faith is the handle for my work around this book and relatedly. I'm also there at Trent Clifford Writes, and that's a combination of my writing and my theater work.
What do you like to read?
I like to read a little bit of everything. I love poetry, as all poets do. I think poets are the only people that read poetry, but that's fine. I love reading plays as well. And again, I think playwrights are the only people that read plays. But in terms of more popular reading, I like a lot of different things. My husband and I like to read together, and we're in the middle of an Agatha Christie novel. Who doesn't love a good mystery? I personally am in the middle of this book called Gathering Moss. The author's last name is Kimmerer. She's a Native American writer, and it is a cultural history of moss. It sounds so dry and so boring at face value. And yet it is fascinating to hear this botanist talk about the cultural wisdom of these tiniest of microorganisms. I love spiritual literature. I love science. I love history. I love a good novel. And I can get lost in a good novel. I'm about to start Barbara Kingsolver's Demon Copperhead. I absolutely loved her novel, Poisonwood Bible. And so I'm excited to start this new one that's been on my shelf for a little while. You look at my bookshelves, of which there are too many, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Everything that you can imagine. That's what's fun. And that's what I love about reading, is that it lets you be everywhere all at once, inside all of these beautiful people's brains all over the world about all these different subjects, and often outside of this world. I love a good fantasy novel, too.
Do you have any words of wisdom to pass along to other queer writers?
My best advice would be to write the stories that you know need told. It's important. It really matters that we tell the stories that we wish we'd had growing up. If I had read this book as a teenager, or if I had heard a pastor endorse someone who looked like me in the pulpit, my whole life trajectory would have been different. I wouldn't have been 22 and coming to grips with my sexuality after proposing to someone I shouldn't have proposed to. I wouldn't have been in seminary grappling with whether I should even be in seminary. Everything would have been different. I encourage queer writers to think back, and this can look like a lot of different things, but what are the stories that would have changed your life? And tell those, because I think we have them and we need more of them.
I will say thank you, Trent Clifford.
Thank you for having me, Wayne. It's been such a pleasure.